It's 4:06. You're listening to Central Time here in the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. I'm Rob Ferret.
And I'm Veronica Rickert. Coming up later, don't be too quick to reach for that sweater and turn up your thermostat this winter. There may be some health benefits to being a little chilly.
First, a new report released from the Children's Advocacy Institute finds that the United States government is falling significantly short in its attempts to keep the nation's youngest residents safe.
According to the latest data, nearly 680,000 children were victims of abuse and neglect in 2013, and an estimated 1,500 children died. But those numbers could actually be higher. The group says that the federal government is failing to properly enact, monitor, and enforce federal child welfare laws, and it's hurting states' ability to get the job done.
Amy Harfeld joins us now. She's the National Policy Director and Senior Staff Attorney at the Children's Advocacy Institute. Amy, welcome to the show.
Thank you for having me.
Well, let's start off with the scope of the problem. We gave some national numbers in the setup there, but is this a problem that's kind of hard to quantify in some ways?
It is, as in most problems that happen primarily within the family, and especially to children who are less likely to report it out of fear. Child abuse is grossly undermeasured, and so the number that you just quoted in terms of the total number of confirmed cases of abuse and neglect in the country, about 680,000, we believe is about a third of the actual number.
And do we have an idea of the scope here in Wisconsin in particular?
You know, I don't have specific Wisconsin data pulled up for the total numbers. I'm sorry.
Oh, that's okay. So looking at the impact of this, what is the cost, before we get into what your report says about how the government is falling down on this, what are the societal costs of all this abuse and neglect?
They are enormous. If you put together all of child welfare spending across the nation, it comes to about $9 billion. But numbers released recently from Prevent Child Abuse America, which is based in Chicago, estimate that 1 year's direct and indirect cost of child abuse and neglect is over $80 billion. So what happens is we underspend on this population in terms of prevention and services for kids who have already been victimized. And we don't serve them well while they're in care, and we don't serve them well when they leave care. And what we see is we pay down the road. So we pay approximately 10 times. What we spend on this population down the road in mental health costs, medical costs, second generations of abuse and neglect in the system, incarceration, homelessness, drug use, and, of course, lost income from a population that's grossly underemployed and often unemployed.
So in this new report, you are highly critical of all three branches of the federal government, executive, legislative, and judicial, in effect, being derelict in their duties to protect America's most vulnerable children. Is this just, you know, fine points of bureaucracy here, or are there things happening that are failing, that are leading to more abuse and neglect for American children?
This report really tries to outline a system that's broken from soup to nuts. I am one of a handful of folks here in Washington, D.C. that serve as lobbyists and advocates for children who have been abused and neglected and who live in foster care. And, of course, my community spends about $1 million a year on these, combined on these lobbying efforts. And, of course, you take another community such as AARP spends about $25 million a year, and that's just an example of how little we can do with the funds that we have. And, of course, abused and neglected kids don't vote and don't pay taxes and have very little political power. So when we really started to connect the dots between what's happening in terms of their being underserviced by all three branches, we really felt that there was a story to tell and to hold different branches of government accountable in terms of reminding them of their responsibilities and roles and pointing out where they've fallen short and where there are opportunities to improve.
Well, as I read
the we started with Congress, and we really did a review of what are the federal child welfare laws that are out there, to what extent are they adequate and appropriate and coordinated, and to what extent are they appropriately funded to actually carry out their mandate.
So are they underfunded, these efforts by Congress?
Yeah, as you can probably imagine, most services, federally funded services to children, are grossly underfunded. And, you know, a big part of this then is results from the fact that we don't invest in the front end of these services and safety nets to protect kids from abuse and neglect in the first place, and to actually make sure that they're taken care of while they're in foster care, and, of course, to make sure that if they leave foster care without being adopted into permanent families, that they're adequately prepared for life on their own. So, yes, services across the board from prevention to aging out are grossly underfunded, and I don't see a lot of hope for them to be adequately funded in the future. We just saw the president's budget come out on Monday, and he has proposed an ambitious and laudable increase for funding in this arena. But given that the Republicans have primarily announced this budget dead on arrival, I don't have a great expectation that most of these provisions will be enacted.
Well, as I read the report, Amy, it seems like there are some what you see as good laws in place, passed by Congress, signed by the president, that call on states to do things, to keep tabs on things like foster care that aren't being done in all states. And you say that people like the Department of Health and Human Services are falling down on the job and keeping the states on track.
That's right, and it's rather alarming. You know, I think back to my days growing up listening to Schoolhouse Rock and understanding how our government was supposed to work. And the whole system of checks and balances here seems to have fallen apart completely. So just as a small example, in 2010, when the Child Abuse Prevention and Treatment Act was reenacted, Congress issued a letter to the Department of Health and Human Services demanding that they issue regulations to make sure that when children are actually killed as a result of abuse and neglect, which is obviously the worst possible outcome, that we at least gather accurate data to make sure we know what happened and where their real systemic flaws lie. HHS, in spite of very passionate advocacy by myself and others and reminders from Congress, simply refused to enact those legislations and refuse to hold states accountable for following what's already in federal law.
So what kind of problems do we maybe keep missing because we don't have that, I guess, kind of transparency out there?
Right. So we can point to the example of fatalities in the meantime, because obviously that's where things go wrong the worst. So when we don't have good information on what happens when children suffer near fatalities or fatalities when they're killed by their parents, we really miss an opportunity to learn the most important lessons about how we can do better and how we can implement meaningful reform. I mean, I'm sure all of your listeners are aware of the stories that hit the headlines of horrible tragedies that befall a particular young person. I'm sure that happened no less often in Wisconsin than in other states. And there is sometimes haphazard, knee-jerk reform that happens as a result of terrible headlines that hit the news. But that's not really a smart way to approach reform to such a big problem. We need to really rely on data and find the deepest cracks to implement meaningful reform. So we hope that HHS really takes seriously its role in overseeing states that are taking federal money from the government to do child welfare services and to hold them accountable for that federal money. You know, no less is expected of other federal agencies.
Now, we've touched on Congress, we've touched on the executive branch. You also say that the judicial system could be doing more to make these things happen, ultimately to prevent abuse and neglect of children.
That's right. So we also try to tie in the courts, because what's happened is in a majority of states in the U.S., including Wisconsin, because states have not enacted the law according to, have not followed their own laws, much less federal laws. States have been sued under class action litigation to better implement the laws that are on the books. Wisconsin had a case in 2002, Janine versus Doyle, which was brought by a number of civil rights groups in Wisconsin as well as children's rights groups. And were sued for constitutional violations, state constitutional and federal constitutional violations against this population. And these lawsuits are very costly and very difficult to bring and go on forever. Many of these suits started before I was even born, and I'm not that old yet. And are still under consent decrees being enforced and are not fully implemented. So when states fail to implement the law and when the federal government fails to enforce the law, these class action suits are made necessary to actually protect this group. It's their last avenue towards to to access justice. And what we've seen, which is very disturbing, is that federal courts are increasingly turning away these cases and not letting them even come to their attention. The courts are claiming abstention, which means that they think it's the state court's business and they don't want to get involved, or they claim that there are some standing issues that bar access to the courts. So when Congress isn't enacting laws that are strong enough and adequately funded, HHS isn't doing their job in enforcing the law, and the federal courts are starting to turn their backs to hear these cases, this group of our most vulnerable citizens in America is really left out in the cold.
Amy, we'll leave it there. Thank you so much for joining us today.
Thank you so much for having me.
That was Amy Harfeld. She's National Policy Director and Senior Staff Attorney at the Children's Advocacy Institute, which just released a report on the federal government, they say, falling down on the job in preventing child abuse and neglect. This is Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret.
And I'm Veronica Rickert. Coming up, a new CDC report says there's too much salt and sugar in food for toddlers. Our guest says kids could be getting off on the wrong foot when it comes to nutrition.
First, it's a fairly cold day in Wisconsin, as these things go, and a lot of us are bundling up, staying inside, keeping warm. But some inventors and researchers say we may be trying too hard to keep warm.
In some cases, they're taking it to what sounds like extreme measures, wearing ice vests and plunging into cold tubs in the hopes of boosting metabolism and avoiding weight gain.
Our next guest checked out the world of shiver therapy to see what was scientifically sound and what remains on the fringe. Dr. James Hamlin is a senior editor and health columnist at The Atlantic. He also hosts a video series called If Our Bodies Could Talk. Dr. Hamlin, welcome to the show.
Thank you for having me.
So you start your piece talking about something that may seem a little crazy in Wisconsin today, where a lot of us woke up to sub-zero temperatures and ice vest. Can you describe that?
I can. The ice vest is a product that has been invented by a professor in California who is trying to harness the potential of the body to burn calories when it's exposed to cold, because not everyone lives in places where it gets cold, and you know, everyone experiences a summer where it's not always cold is not always easy to come by. And the idea is that your body has to maintain its temperature of 98.6 degrees. So when it's exposed to cold, it burns calories just to maintain that temperature. And that as an adjunct to good diet and exercise and everything else that you would normally do to be healthy, this might give some people an extra boost in calorie burning. That's the idea, at least.
Mm-hmm. And this, is there much science behind this idea that being more cold, whether it's with an ice vest or without, being more cold helps us metabolize better, I guess, lose weight?
Yes, there's science actually going back centuries on this. And it's an interesting story. The inventor of a popular trend a few years ago that was written about in Timothy Ferris's The 4-Hour Body, it was a trend of ice baths and exposure to extreme cold. And it sort of became popular around the work of a NASA materials scientist named Ray Cronus. And what he would do is go out in the middle of winter with no shirt on and take shiver walks. And he would take cool showers in the 60 to 70 degree range, which, you know, not freezing, but it would feel cooler than we're used to for showers. And it helped him lose weight, he claims. He did a TED talk about it. He was written up in this book. He had been watching Michael Phelps, who during his big Olympic run in 2008 told the news media that he was eating 12,000 calories a day. And Cronus was worked at NASA. He's a scientist. So he just said, that's not possible. No one could eat that many calories without losing weight, or without gaining weight, mm-hmm. I'm sorry. And so Cronus figured it out that it must be because Phelps was spending so much time in cold water that his body was actually burning calories just to keep itself warm, and that accounted for the extra difference that allowed him to eat so many calories.
Well, it seems like the swimming might have had something to do with it. He did a lot of that.
Absolutely. But, you know, running a marathon on average is going to burn only about a little more than 2,000 calories for someone. Exercise has a lot of health benefits, but straight-up calorie burning is is not necessarily one of them. You have to work out a lot to burn calories. So to burn off 12,000 calories in a day, you would have to be swimming 24 hours straight. Even Michael Phelps couldn't do it.
Well, there's kind of an evolutionary argument. You point out that a lot of us, or the humans, evolved in often cold situations, and now we're fighting that. We're keeping ourselves at a pretty constant temperature.
That is where the work of these scientists has taken them now, to look at a bigger picture. You know, wearing an ice vest, sort of an interesting idea, not very practical, but that same principle can make you wonder, what is the fact that we are constantly exposed to warm environments year-round, artificially warm environments, in a way that 100 years ago we weren't? Has that had any effect on these skyrocketing rates of obesity and chronic disease that we have right now? I mean, that's a correlation. There are lots of correlations. There's a correlation with the rise of bottled water and Post-it notes and the rates of obesity. But this isn't one that, when you pair it with some evolutionary science about the effects of mild stress on the body, when the body's under mild stress, cold being one of them, there is activation of some metabolic pathways that can be advantageous in burning fat. So it's very theoretical, but it kind of fits together in an interesting way.
Now, did you try one of these ice vests on?
Oh, I had to try it on, yes.
How long did you actually wear it?
I wore it until it was melted, which is the theory. It usually about an hour and a half until it is up to room temperature, your body has warmed it up.
Now, my guess would be that this would be horrible. Am I right?
It was not great. When you first put it on, it feels very cold. I am told that if you become a habitual user, you get used to it. And it wasn't, you know, if you've ever put an ice pack on your ankle or knee after an injury, you know the feeling. Mm-hmm. This is slightly better because you're still supposed to wear a shirt underneath it, so it's not ice directly on your skin. But the whole sensation of it being all over you is kind of probably similar to going outside in a T-shirt in the middle of winter. You want to get back in. But you get used to it, and the ice starts melting, and then all you're left with is the questions from everyone who sees you about what you're wearing.
You said you can get habituated to it. Are there people who are doing, whether it's at the ice vest or other forms of, I think you call it shiver therapy, do people say, oh, yeah, it's bad at first, but yeah, after a while, it's not a big deal being super cold all the time?
It is. People say that they get used to it. You know, I guess as much as anyone gets used to being cold by the end of winter, whereas the first few cold days of winter might be less tolerable, they do say that they get used to it.
Hmm. So is there something to be done here for those of us who are never going to try an ice vest, never going to do that ice bath as a therapeutic technique? Could it make a difference, just, I guess, thermostat down a little more, not so many blankets, smaller steps?
Well, here's the way I think about it. You're not hurting anything by trying that. Actually, saving a little bit of energy by turning your thermostat down a little bit, not feeling like you need to bundle yourself up in multiple layers just because you look at the cover of the J. Crew catalog and it's got someone in a flannel and a cardigan and a scarf, just because it is winter outside. But for a lot of us who don't work outdoors and kind of go out to our car, drive to work, spend our whole day in a climate-controlled environment, and then drive back to a climate-controlled house, our day-to-day is not that much different between summer and winter, at least during a work day. So do you really need the space heater under your desk? Do you really need to be layering your clothes? It's kind of a cultural and psychological thing. And once you get used to being a little bit cooler, you realize that you're saving some energy, you're potentially returning your body to this exposure of some mild cold that for hundreds and hundreds of years the human body was used to experiencing, that can't hurt.
Has this led to a lifestyle change for you, whether it's, you know, wearing one less layer or going all the way to regular ice vest use?
It has made me conscious of not layering so much and thinking, I might be going out to dinner on a winter night, but I'm just going to be going out to a cab and then into a restaurant and then you know, going from place to place that are heated, places that are heated, do I really need to bring a coat? Probably not. So I think about it in that way. I would not wear an ice vest or go to any lengths to go out of my way for this or really put myself in any degree of discomfort because the science is so preliminary and theoretical. But just thinking about it has made me realize that I might be going overboard on trying to keep myself warm all winter.
So when my kids refuse to wear a scarf or hang around in shorts all inside all through the winter, maybe not such a big deal.
I wouldn't worry about it.
Excellent. Well, that's good to know. Dr. Hamlin, thank you so much for joining us today.
Yeah, thank you so much for having me.
That was Dr. James Hamlin, editor and health columnist at The Atlantic. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret.
And I'm Veronica Rickert. Still ahead, we take a closer look at Governor Walker's education budget proposals.
But first, a new study by the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention says the majority of prepackaged meals and snacks for toddlers contain high levels of salt or sugar.
The study looked at dinners like macaroni and cheese, mini hot dogs, cereals, and fruit snacks. It found that in some cases, single servings of food contained 1.5 times the recommended sodium levels per serving.
Meanwhile, it found that 2/3 of the calorie count in some snacks were made up entirely of sugar. The researchers warn these foods could be putting children at risk and could lead to serious health problems down the road.
Jim O'Hara joins us with reaction to the study. He's the Health Promotion Policy Director at the Center for Science in the Public Interest. Jim, welcome to Central Time.
Good afternoon. Pleased to be with you today, Veronica.
Well, this news may come as a surprise to some people, but was this a surprise to you, the sugar and salt content in toddler foods?
It was and it wasn't. What we know is that in processed food, sodium content varies widely, and we know that in many processed foods, sodium content can be very high. And in fact, most of us get around 75-80% of our sodium intake each day from processed or restaurant foods. What's important about this study is it's really the first comprehensive and systematic look at toddler and infant foods.
And in terms of how much this matters, that these foods are coming in higher than the recommended levels of sugar and sodium, why does it matter for health?
It matters for a number of reasons. First off, again, we know from the scientific evidence that taste preferences for salty, sweet foods get set early in life. So if infants and toddlers are consuming too much sugar and salt, then it's likely to have impact on their dietary habits as they grow older. And in fact, the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention published another study last September showing that almost 9 in 10 U.S. children, 6 to 18, are eating more sodium each day than they should. So first off, it sets kids on a path that can have health impacts. And then that's the second issue, really are the health impact. As the authors of the study that came out this week reported, almost 80% of U.S. children age 1 to 3 already exceed 1,500 milligrams a day of sodium. That's the recommended upper limit by the Institute of Medicine. In addition, moving to the added sugars in the diet, 23% of U.S. children aged 2 to 5 are overweight or obese, and we know that the added sugar is contributing to that.
Well, you talk about the foods that were studied, things like macaroni and cheese and cereals, mini hot dogs. These are convenience foods, and lots of them, you know, they're kind of staples of childhood. Macaroni and cheese is a standby and has been for decades.
Absolutely.
So where does the problem come in?
Well, as I say, the problem comes in that in our processed food, frankly, too much sodium is being used. The Institute of Medicine in 2010 recommended that the Food and Drug Administration reduce sodium in our food supply. Do it gradually because it's going to take time. Do it in a stair-step fashion so that people's tastes get acclimated. do it in a reasonable fashion. Various foods have various sodium needs. So, I mean, the real question here is what the food industry can do. And given what the CDC study showed this week, it's incumbent upon parents and caregivers to take a look at the nutrition facts labels on the products that they buy, compare them, see which are high in sodium, which are low in sodium. The CDC study that came out this week said that 3/4 of the products were high in sodium. That meant that they had more than 210 milligrams of sodium per serving. Toddler meals had on average 360 milligrams of sodium per serving. For toddlers ages 12 to 36, an adequate intake is only 1,000 milligrams of sodium a day.
So give us a sense of what is a healthy amount for sugar and salt for kids.
Well, again, as I said, the Institute of Medicine has said that for toddlers ages 12 to 36 months, an adequate intake, an intake that allows them to develop in a healthy fashion, is 1,000 milligrams a day. The upper level for that age group is 1,500 milligrams a day. Added sugar shouldn't be in the diet of infants and toddlers. And so, again, when you take a look at what this study says, it means that the food industry needs to do a better job. It means parents and caregivers need to be taking a look at food labels, or if their children, their toddlers, are, say, in a child care setting, they should be talking with the child care facility about what nutrition standards the child care facility follows.
So you're looking at this from two angles. On the one hand, you'd like to see the food companies themselves dialing down the sugar and salt, and you also want parents themselves to be more vigilant. Do you think that in the meantime, you know, this is going to take some time to implement if it happens, sugar and salt being reduced, that parents should think about cooking more and buying fewer of these pre-prepared foods?
Well, obviously, that when parents and caregivers can, using fresh fruits and vegetables is the best way to go. But we also need to be realistic and understand, as you mentioned earlier, that at times there's a convenience factor that needs to be taken into account. And again, that is why it's so important to look at the nutrition facts label to understand what it says. One of the things that is happening right now is the nutrition facts label is going to undergo a revision. When it was first put in place in 1993, it was based on the best available dietary science at the time. Obviously, in the decades since then, we've learned more. And one of the proposals that the Food and Drug Administration has made for the nutrition facts label is to have a separate line that says how much added sugar is in a food. That's a proposal that really needs to happen, again, so that parents and caregivers have the information they need to make the healthy decision.
Now, if you look at the shelves of a grocery store, you'll see high-salt, high-sugar prepackaged foods marketed to kids of all ages and not just toddlers here. Why does the food industry want to appeal to kids and to do it using, apparently, sugar and salt?
Well, you know, that's really a question for industry to answer. But you're right about the fact that right now, even beyond the toddler years, as I said, CDC looked at sodium intake for American youth between 6 and 18. They found that on average, American youth in that age group are consuming about 3,300 milligrams of sodium a day. That's probably even an underestimate. And the recommended amount of sodium, according to the dietary guidelines, is only 2,300. That's 1,000 plus milligrams extra a day. And most of that sodium is coming from 10 foods. And again, those are foods that shouldn't surprise any of us. Pizza, bread and rolls, cold cuts and cured meats, sandwiches like cheeseburgers, snacks. And so there really does need to be an effort among the food industry to reduce the sodium in the processed food, in the restaurant foods. And until that happens, it's then sort of caveat emptor. It really is parents and caregivers in the marketplace.
Is part of this because, you know, kids eat those foods. Kids eat hot dogs and macaroni and cheese. I mean, it can be
sure.
A battle to get a child to eat anything, especially in the fussy toddler years. If we take out, you know, some of the stuff that makes it taste good, are you going to have kids who just aren't eating stuff?
No. You can clearly have tasty food. You can use herbs and spices. There are plenty of ways to make food very appealing to toddlers and youth.
We're talking right now with Jim O'Hara, Health Promotion Policy Director at the Center for Science and the Public Interest, about a new study saying many toddler foods contain high amounts of salt and sugar.
And we want to hear from you, your questions, your thoughts, and your experiences. Are you now or have you ever been the parents of a toddler, a child, a teen? How do you resolve these issues, the food with the convenience foods, the ones that are easy to cook, easy to get kids to eat? But they got a lot of salt, a lot of sugar in them. Is this a battle in your household? Do you work in Wisconsin's food industry? Love to hear your perspective as well. And what were things like for you growing up? Did you eat a lot of salty, sugary foods? Did that stick with you? Did it form a habit for life? Call now at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. You can also email talk@WPR.org.
Right now, a check of the latest headlines with Kristen Durst.
This is Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret.
And I'm Veronica Rickert. Right now, we're talking with Jim O'Hara of the Center for Science and the Public Interest about the amount of sugar and salt in toddler foods and what it means for children's health.
And you can join us at 800-642-1234. As a parent, do you or did you struggle with the choice between the healthy stuff and the convenient stuff with the tempting sugar and salt for toddlers, kids, teens? Are you surprised to hear that there's so much sugar and salt in foods sold really for toddlers? Call in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234 or email talk@WPR.org.
We'll go to our first caller now. We have Lorena on the line from Gurnee, Illinois. Hi, Lorena.
Hello.
What do you think?
I think it is a struggle because, you know, a lot of parents, they both work and it's... hard finding time to actually cook healthy things for our kids. And so I, with my children, maybe because I got married young, I had children young, maybe in my mid-20s, and I was ignorant to a lot of things. But I think what's key is for parents to educate themselves on reading the labels, which, I mean, you hear about everywhere, and kind of getting your kids into little by little introducing them to foods that are lower, and they get it. I grew up eating nothing but junk, and I told myself when my kids got, you know, to grade school or whatever, and I educated myself a little bit more that I was not going to do that with my children. And so it's not to say that we eat healthy all the time, but we're a lot more conscious of what of reading labels and making healthier choices.
Lorena, thanks a lot for sharing that. And Lorena has educated herself. How big a part of this is education, getting people to be aware of the sugar and salt content in food and to make choices based on that? And Jim, your response?
Yes, Veronica. I was going to say, I mean, public education, public health education plays an important role. And for instance, the current debate we're having in the nation about the nutrition standards for school meals is an important debate because it's informing the public, it's informing parents, it's informing caregivers that, in fact, you can eat healthy and still eat tasty. There are plenty of ways. In fact, when you take a look at many of the products that the food industry is providing to the schools, you'll see that, in fact, they are meeting the targets in the recently passed legislation that calls for reducing sodium, for instance. And so this can be done, and it can be done in a way that, again, makes it so that it's not that kind of a struggle with your kid. I have two teenage boys, and I well remember the struggles we had.
All right. Well, thank you so much for your call, Lorraine. Appreciate that. And let's move on next to Jeff in Watertown. Jeff, hi.
Hi. I'm a pediatrician, actually, and we talk about this all the time, every single day in the clinic. And one of the issues is that especially preschoolers are not hungry every day. They're actually, their body mass index is dropping from about age 2 to age 5 or 6, depending on if you're a boy or a girl. So it really needs to be known by parents so that they are not forcing them to eat when they're not hungry. And your point that you have foods that you can always eat, and so fine, we'll give it to them because at least they'll put something in their mouth. You don't have to. They will eat when they're hungry, and you need to let them stop if they're not hungry. And then you can avoid some of this force feeding that we do to our children.
Well, thanks a lot, Jeff. Appreciate that perspective from a pediatrician there. Jeff saying, you know, children will eat when they're hungry, and if you have foods that they're used to eating that are healthier, that are there, it doesn't have to be a big production. What do you think, Jim?
No, I think that that's a very important point. And, in fact, in the article that was published this week by the CDC researchers, they point out about how, again, a crucial role, and this goes back to the education point, a crucial role that pediatricians can play in their counseling of parents. Children go for regular wellness visits, and those sessions can become very important educational sessions for parents. I know, again, speaking of my own experience, going to the pediatrician for those wellness visits, we got many very helpful tips on what we could do to ensure a healthier diet for our two sons.
And back to the calls we go now. We've got Lucy with us next in Delafield. Hi, Lucy.
Hi there. I work full-time, so does my husband, and we have a 1.5- and 6-year-old, so we know the trick of getting them to eat. Some of the things we've tried is just trying to prep meals ahead that we can freeze and then take out that are quickly, made. We make some of our own things like ketchup that are lower in sodium and sugar. And I think getting the kids involved has really helped us. So if they're involved in the preparation and the cooking, they seem to be more apt to eat it. The same goes for getting them involved, helping in the garden and those kinds of things, too. And I just wanted to suggest a book called French Kids Eat Everything, and it's about a Canadian mom who moved her kids to France, and they were picky eaters, and just the fundamental difference in how different cultures approach food is a good read.
Right. That's an interesting one. We actually interviewed the author on this show, Lucy. And since you seem like you've got a good handle on this, what are some of the meals that you freeze and cook with your kids ahead of time?
Well, we do some healthier toddler muffins that are low in sugar, and we've tried to even sneak in some vegetable purees so they don't know. Mm-hmm. Soups a lot of times. We'll even do, just frozen pastas. And sometimes it's just even leftovers that we freeze in smaller kid-sized containers.
Great. Well, those are some good ideas, Lucy. Thank you so much for calling. And Lucy is getting her kids involved in the whole eating process, which sounds like it gives them a bigger stake in what they're going to eat later. Is that one way to go, Jim?
Absolutely. In fact, I was going to say in response to her comments that getting children involved in the kitchen, again, is a really important way to get them more knowledgeable about what they're eating. And the American Heart Association on its website has a number of kid-friendly recipes. And so there are those resources out there for your listeners to involve their children in their cooking and their food preparation.
Well, Lucy, thanks for the call. And we'll go next to Sharon in Door County. Hi, Sharon.
Hi, Kirsten. Thank you for taking my call. This is a subject that is kind of one of my soapboxes because there is so much knowledge to be shared via various resources. There is a documentary that I would highly encourage anyone, and I actually have the idea that it should be shown as a movie to all children that are in school at a certain grade level where they would, enhance their understanding of what actually is a calorie, because a calorie isn't always a calorie. And there's a lot more that's on this documentary, but a quick example of that is, if you have 160 calories of almonds, which is about a small handful, and you eat that, you're going to have a slow release of the blood sugar, which then also has a slow release of the insulin. But if you compare that now to someone who has a Coke for a soda, and that's 160 calories, that is going to have an immediate increase, almost, of the blood sugar going up, which then all of a sudden, instead of it being a slow release, insulin has to shoot out. It's like a fan going instead of just turning a slow switch. And that causes an output of fat. And the sugar is, according to the documentary, fed up. The sugar is four times more addictive than cocaine.
Sugar addictive. That's something we've heard recently, that foods containing high concentrations of sugar, salt, fat can have an addictive effect on us, as Sharon says. Is that a factor that doctors are worried about, Jim?
I think it's becoming more and more of a worry. In fact, Dr. Nora Volkow, who is the head of the National Institute of Drug Abuse, she has an excellent video on TEDx, if any of your listeners ever look at that on the web, in which she talks about the whole issue of foods, especially foods that are heavy in sugar, salt, and fat, and what it does in terms of the brain, rewiring the brain chemistry. But, you know, the point that your listener was making about sugary drinks like sodas, like juices that are less than 100% fruit juices, which many parents think, well, gee whiz, that's healthy, it's a fruit juice. Well, it's not. And, in fact, those calories are empty calories.
And we have to leave it there. Jim, thank you so much for your time today. We've been speaking with Jim O'Hara, Health Promotion Policy Director at the Center for Science in the Public Interest.